This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lesher-Shute. If you didn't grow up with it, 4-H is quite a phenomenon, and its work goes way beyond the fair. It's about teaching kids of all ages how to become leaders. The organization, started in 1905, now has 6 million participants. It's administered by the USDA and organized by university extensions. 4-H has an expansive mandate. In 2017, it actually set a goal to, quote, reflect the population demographics, vulnerable populations, diverse needs, and social conditions of the country. It was part of an effort to make 4-H accessible to kids of all cultural and economic backgrounds. Jean-Paul Chazon Cardenas was hired as part of this campaign in Iowa. With innovative, culturally based programs, he doubled the participation of youth of color in the Iowa 4-H program. But when Jean-Paul tried to include LGBTQ youth in the Iowa program by bringing new national USDA guidelines on how to make them feel comfortable in local clubs forward, he was fired. And following this controversy in Iowa, the USDA rescinded its own national guidelines on LGBTQ youth. Today, I'm speaking with Jason Clayworth, an investigative reporter from the Des Moines Register who has been covering this story. I'm also talking to Jean-Paul Chazon Cardenas and Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy.
This is Sophie Akoff, National Field Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. I've been a member of the coalition since 2012 because I believe that our food system will be healthier and more just if young farmers have a say in their future. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to helping young farmers make their voices heard, you'll get discounts like 16% off a two-wheel tractor at BCS America and 10% off at Premier One. It's a great deal. To join, simply go to youngfarmers.org.
To get started, Jason, can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Jason Clayworth. I'm an investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register in Des Moines, Iowa.
I'm just wondering how you came to this story.
So myself and another reporter, Courtney Crowder, launched this review after our state fired its 4-H director. There were a lot of unanswered questions about why he was fired, and so we began looking at it. Ultimately, the Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, their executives made the decision to fire Jean-Paul. The decision to fire him was based on, I've forgotten exactly the words that they used, but basically his inability to work well with the organization as a whole. Their reasoning has not been exactly clear, but when we look at the documents and what was going on at that time, their concerns were centered primarily on this issue of transgender youth participants.
So tell us, can you tell us just from the beginning, what was this policy around transgender participants in 4-H, and where did that come from?
Back in 1991, the USDA and extension leaders in the various states wrote a document that pushed the university extensions to become more diverse and multicultural. In 2015, 4-H headquarters were receiving a lot of questions about how to best include LGBT students in their local programming. And so with that...
And this is the national headquarters?
Yes, yes. And so with that, there was a working group put together of various leaders who were asked to adapt some of the Obama administration's suggestions on how to include gender identity rights into various policies. And so that group put together recommendations that ultimately were approved by the National 4-H Association and were posted as guidance on a federal website. And it's important to note that national website is part of the USDA. It was posted, And some of the state organizations, including Iowa, picked that language up and those suggestions and began to review or implement them relatively quickly.
How many state organizations took that guidance and incorporated it into their own policy and practices?
You know, it was difficult for us to pinpoint exactly how widespread the document was used. It was only on the website briefly, like less than 2 weeks, if that. And so it was a relatively short period of time. What we do know is that the USDA removed those recommendations and then very shortly after sent notices to some states asking them to remove that information from their own state sites.
Do you have any sense of what led them to, you know, take down this guidance and in fact instruct states to remove it from their own sites?
Well, what we know is what was obviously what's been going on in the federal government in regard to the issue of transgender rights. The Trump administration has since worked to reverse some of those protections that were put into place under President Obama.
Is it unusual for an administration to remove policies, or is this sort of an unusual thing to happen, or is this not out of the ordinary?
In our review, and we asked dozens of our sources as we worked several months on this investigation, we could not find an example in the past decade where an advisory policy had been completely rescinded. And the USDA took the unusual step to send notices to the states that were using this policy, sending urgent messages, that's their word, urgent, to remove the policies from their state websites as well.
And what was USDA's reason for doing this?
So we spent several months contacting the USDA. We got one response, and they said that the guidance policy wasn't properly vetted. The policy that deals with transgender rights, however, said specifically that it had been approved by National 4-H headquarters, as well as this working group that had been put together, at least partly, to look at this issue in 2016. Our follow-up questions weren't answered about, you know, what specifically, what was done incorrectly in this approval, and we've never gotten an answer to that. What we know from talking with our sources is that some of the highest management of USDA was involved in this issue and did guide the decision to rescind this policy.
I'm just trying to think about other instances where transgender rights might be written into USDA policy or related. Do you have a sense of just generally USDA's position on transgender rights? Are there places that the agency has weighed in on this issue?
Well, if you listen to the opponents of transgender rights, in at least this policy, they will tell you that the federal government regulations, they believe, are illegal. And there are advocates who are quite adamant in their arguments that these provisions are unconstitutional.
Can you walk me through that? I'm having a hard time figuring out like the logic there.
They believe that it violates, for one, freedom of speech in some manner, because it prohibits people from saying that they object or that they have some type of moral objection to the overall issue.
And I just wonder about the consequences for 4-H as an organization and for young transgender LGBTQ kids interested in pursuing 4-H and joining a club. Have you heard about any stories or anecdotes about like how the 4-H program is faring, you know, post this decision?
So absolutely. That's a great question, because that's really, we could back up just a little bit. A year plus ago, the Iowa 4-H was looking at its inclusive policies. And that's really what John Paul was looking at. And so that was the context of what was going on in Iowa is you know, that we have had issues in the state where transgender participants in 4-H have met some difficulties in participating.
Where is that showing up?
So in our investigation, we obtained more than 500 pages of state and federal communications on this issue. And in part of those, there are documents, for example, this is one example, where there were pictures of a cow and it said something about white face. And it was an issue where it might have been innocent, but it came off as cruel and insensitive. Or another example would be where a 4-H member had a Confederate flag flying from a pickup truck at a county fair. And so these were issues that, you know, they're deeply divisive type social issues and issues that are going on in our national conversation about diversity. And I think what's interesting is that the response that this federal document generated from the states, we saw multiple examples from multiple states of parents that I would imagine have good intentions. They expressed what I believe in their correspondence were legitimate or at least sincere concerns about the problems that they see in this policy. I'm not professing that they're right, but I can understand in some ways how they come about their point of view. And so they have sincere concerns. On the other hand, you have folks whose children are, at least feel that they are unable to participate because of these recommendations. And so you have two factions that believe in their heart that they are doing or advocating for what's best for the participants and children in this important system. 4-H is important. So, you know, that's reflected in these records. And as I was reading them, I could see how the pressure from both sides had really been put on both national and state organizers who were you could argue that they're trying to do what's right.
This was really interesting. Is there anything else that you wanted to make sure that we covered in this story?
I will say that this was an extensive review, and you know, this is a little bit of a plug for local newspapers, but it is local news organizations like the Des Moines Register that review these matters, and you know, without being able to spend time on these type of projects, the general public would largely be uninformed. And so, you know, I give a shout out to news organizations that take a little extra effort behind the scenes and try to hold our government accountable. And this really is a question of accountability, not only 4-H accountability, but our accountability as a society and whether or not we extend our civil rights protections to various groups or all groups. And that's the debate that is generated nationally and in states and local 4-H groups.
Here's Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy. He was the director of the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, appointed under President Obama, and he was at USDA when the LGBTQ guidelines were rescinded.
Well, hi, Lindsay. Hey, thanks so much for having me on your podcast here. This is Sunny Ramaswamy. I mean, I was in Washington, D.C. For 6 years. And in 2018, early 2018, the guidelines are shared with the folks at the National 4-H headquarters and asked if this is something that is against what NIFA is all about, the U.S. government is all about. And the feedback provided at that time was, well, no, this is perfectly aligned with all the rules and regulations and laws, right? The constitutional guarantee that is afforded everybody, every man, woman, and child in America is afforded a constitutional guarantee. It was not a, there's not a formal process. You send it to us, we look at it, we bless you to go for it. No, it was just an informal conversation and things like that. And that happens. And then and it's shared widely through all the states. So the 4-H leadership community from across America asks the NIFA 4-H headquarters if it might be that particular guidelines document might be put on the NIFA website. And so it was put up. I didn't know about it. I was the director of the agency at that time. I had no clue about it. Until what happens is that there was these were guidelines were all shared widely through all the states, and as I understand it, as I know it, a parent in Virginia complained that they didn't want to be part of this organization anymore because they didn't want their children to be exposed to, subjected to this new idea about gays and lesbians being part of the okay. And I heard about the fact that in Iowa there was a parent, and in North Dakota, there was an individual, literally a handful, literally. And so I didn't, I did not know that we had it on our website. And until the secretary, i.e. Sonny Perdue's office, called me and said, hey, we want to talk to you. And I'm going to share names with you. Heidi Green was the chief of staff for the secretary. She called me, and Merrill Broussard, it was my deputy at that time, and he's still there, into the their office. And, I mean, literally, the old riot act, right? On me, I'm a head of an agency, and I don't need to, be subjected to that sort of a verbal abuse. In any case, I asked her to calm down. Let's talk about it. And she wanted to know, who did it? Who made the decision to put this on the website? This is not policy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I said, okay, let's kind of calm down. Let me go back, and Meryl and I will find out a little bit more and get back to you. And so we discovered that an individual made the unilateral decision against our policy in NIFA is that there's a vetting process for any information that goes on the website, right? Internal vetting process that everybody knew. And it was just somehow something got through, right?
Would it have been approved?
By me?
By whomever. Like, obviously the process wasn't followed, so that's one thing. But do you think if it had gone through the proper channels, would there have been any reason to reject it?
No, I would not have rejected it.
I was hoping that you could just introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is John Paul Chasson Cardenas. What else do you
want to know? John Paul, you have a new role working with organizations on inclusion.
Yeah, I've actually been working on the issue of inclusion for over 25 years. In addition, I'm finishing my doctorate at the University of Iowa, so I'm spending a lot of time trying to get comps and dissertation and all that stuff done.
John Paul, what led you to become the youth development leader at 4-H in Iowa?
I actually was headhunted. I was asked to come in to a program that had been reviewed federally for having some deficiencies around the issue of cultural competence and inclusion. And so I was brought in to start working on those issues.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? What were some of the issues identified at that time? And were they just Iowa specific or national or both?
National, actually. There was a lot of work since 2002. 4-H had identified that it was losing folks head over heels, just kind of losing its population. And part of it was that it had become a very white, middle-class, rural organization, even though really it's designed to be for all communities and all people in the United States, being a federally, a congressionally authorized program. And so in 2002, we began a process of trying to move 4-H to towards being more inclusive. And then in 2016, that kind of reached resonance when the leadership of 4-H at the national level voted a document called 4-H Grows a Promise to American Kids, declaring that in 10 years, 4-H would reflect the population, demographics, diverse needs, and social conditions of the country.
So I've heard you talk about really wanting 4-H in Iowa to serve all kids. And I wondered if you could talk about that and also some of your success in broadening the scope of 4-H in Iowa and who it was serving directly.
Well, it was not only in Iowa. The national state, so the state leaders, people who had my previous position across the United States, really took and voted to make that 4-H promise, that reflection of that the youth and the volunteers and the staff would reflect the communities as a whole. So it was a national movement to get that done.
And what were some of the actions that you took to make that possible?
Well, we were recognized nationally for several of the things we did. We created programs to be able to bring youth of color. And in my tenure, we actually doubled the number of youth of color in our programs. We did a lot around trying to make it more accessible for low-income youth to come in. We started to deliberately target some of the youth that sometimes get left out, even though they're in the ag sector. And think about the kids of people who work in the poultry plants or work in beef production and migrant workers. And we did that with a great deal of success. We also attempted to make it so, after we had some reports of some incidents with some of our youth, to welcome and make sure that youth who were LGBTQ were part and parcel of our program.
The efforts to diversify 4-H, both in programming and as well as, really achieving racial equity within the program, I wonder, what led the organization to do that? Were there complaints of bias? It seems like the statistics back that up in terms of who was predominantly using the program. What sorts of stories had you heard about the program and barriers that it was presenting structurally or culturally?
Well, I think anybody who's been in 4-H at the national level and even in local communities has seen how 4-H look and how is in the composition of 4-H, who is in 4-H. And so a lot of the work was trying to get those youth who may not have had a history of 4-H. I was there when the national leaders looked at this and said, this needs to change. And so I think that's part of the where some of the resistance came to having any. The other thing is that 4-H does reflect a gamut of the political landscape in the United States. And some of these social perception battles around who belongs and does not belong in the United States are being fought. You know, some of the populations that I found in my experience and I saw with my own eyes and I heard the stories of being excluded from 4-H, at least in the state that I'm in, are populations like immigrants, are LGBTQ youth, are Latinos, are African Americans, who just weren't seen as part of 4-H. And we work very hard to try to create programs where they would feel an interest to try to move them from not even inclusion, because that's not what 4-H really demands. That's not in the model. But really what 4-H demands at its core is belonging, that those youth feel a sense of belonging in the program.
You mentioned in another quote, I'm trying to find this here, you said that we can have difficult conversations, but we can do it in the context of joy and fun. I just wondered, you know, how 4-H handled that and how, like, the context of joy and fun was able to help kids, you know, come together.
You know, one of the things that I found when I was in 4-H, it was usually not the youth who had the issues. And that's part of the reason I fell in love with 4-H, is because it had that philosophy of bringing kids together. And again, this was not, you know, the situation with exclusion. A lot of times, some of it came from kids, but usually it came from the adults. It came from the, you know, 30-year volunteer, fifth generation that decided that 4-H didn't look the same because they're doing folkloric dance, or, you know, that decided that they don't want particular kids to use a bathroom or not because, you know, they don't, you know, identify as what gender they would want them to identify. Those are the things that really got in the way of 4-H. It's not so much the youth, it was the adults.
So I do want to talk about, of course, the LGBTQ policy and what happened with that. I wonder if you could tell us, so you were hired to sort of with this mandate to help 4-H adapt, become more inclusive. And as part of that, there was, I guess, also a mandate and a need to serve LGBTQ youth more effectively. Could you tell me about what you were hearing in terms of families feeling like the organization wasn't serving them?
Well, we started looking at it, and like every program, anybody who has and works with youth, you find youth that they don't fit in. And those youth, a lot of times, were LGBTQ youth, including a couple different cases where youth were going through transition. And I had a staff in county communities and other places asking questions about, you know, what do we do when youth are transitioning? And, you know, how do we serve him? How can we do it? You know, especially when if a youth goes into a fair, to a bathroom, you know, they may be treated in, you know, way X or Y, Z. And so we looked at what was happening at the national level. And under President Obama, there had been a mandate in the federal government to set policy and rules around how to make 4-H in all programs, quite frankly, more inclusive for LGBTQ youth. And we began to work with those. There was also an effort at the national level started by some of our Western states like California and Idaho, and that studied the issue and proposed some rules that mimicked, at the time, the Department of Education's welcoming policy. And so we looked at those. Those went through approval through the regular channels at USDA and with the state leaders. And we actually took the text and adapted it for Iowa. The first part was the actual policy of inclusion. And in that section, all we did is really take the state and federal laws as they existed and the university policy, and we repeated them. We didn't change anything. We just repeated what they were doing. Then there was a definition section to help people understand the terminology around LGBTQ students. And then there was guidance. And the guidance itself looked at things like if a youth asked to change their name in 4-H, you know, we really do need to change their name. It's their choice. And if a youth requests to use a particular bathroom that conforms with their gender identity, we really need to allow the kid to use the bathroom. And so those are the kinds of things that we did for guidance for our counties to be able to look at and to follow a set of rules that made sense. By the way, what we did was a proposal. We only proposed it. We never actually passed it. And we were going through the listening section of that when we had a nationally recognized hate group start creating a campaign to target specifically me, but also the 4-H program in Iowa, Idaho, and several other states to repeal these things. And it got picked up by some local groups. And we received several thousand letters, emails, calls that went not only to me, but to the office of the governor. We had congressional people call in, et cetera, which got exacerbated to the point of making it where some folks in at the university that we're in and USDA moved and pulled the policies back. And so the Trump administration, as reported by the Des Moines Register, pulled back the guidance on this while we had it still open for public discussion and left Iowa in a very awkward situation.
So just in terms of timeline, so the Trump, the Western states, a national committee of 4-H leaders came together to publish guidance for all 4-H programs across the country. Those were posted at the USDA website, and then you picked it up in Iowa, and then the controversy started.
Correct. And then it was rescinded federally. And then Iowa State University decided to rescind it after that.
What were the comments that you received from, were they residents of Iowa? Were they folks from across the country?
Both. We had a lot of folks who external, I think something like 60% of folks, if I remember correctly, please, who were national people from other places rather than Iowa speaking, but about 40% actually came from Iowa. And we had, you know, a whole mix of different comments. And I actually have a couple here that I can read to you that might be helpful. Here's, you know, both, I'll read some pro and against. I just want to say thank you. Last year, I was humiliated and kicked out of 4-H by one of the volunteers for being gay. My parents went to the director in the county extension office, who shouted at them for not raising a normal kid and that I should suck it up and get over it. I had promised never to come back to 4-H, but if this policy passes, I will join my senior year. Here's another one by a young woman that says, I am a lesbian 4-H'er. I have not told my club because it does not feel safe. This policy made me feel welcome. And then we had the converse, things like, so the people who were opposing it were said, this policy only addresses those with deviant sexual expressions. What about the protection of normal children from sexual predators, adults? We had another one that said, if I have a male pig, can I enter it in the breeding gilding competition? We had another one that said, you know, this policy opens the door for rapists and pedophiles. So a lot of the comments that came in opposing the policy really talked about this mythology of if you are an LGBT person, you are a pedophile. you know, this actually, when we got this type of feedback, I actually hardened on my opinion that we really need to set some protections for youth. Because if this is the type of environment that our youth are living in, then we have to be very clear that we will support youth, no matter where they come from in our program. And that's what we were trying to do. So when everything
happened. Were these comments from mainly parents and adults, or were they from kids as well?
We had parents, adults, we had club leaders, we had some staff comment, we had youth, and then we had a lot of people who were completely unaffiliated with 4-H also comment and make some, you know.
Why do you think, Jean-Paul, you're such a lightning rod for this? Why do you think that the Iowa program in particular was the target of so much of really, you know, this feedback and this controversy?
Well, I think Iowa has always had a very special place in the political landscape of the United States. You know, we're the first in the nation to vote. And, you know, so this is a place where a lot of these things get tested. I am not sure beyond that why they picked me personally and why did they pick the 4-H program, except for it might have been fertile ground.
I just wonder what do you think 4-H should do about this situation? Like, how, I mean, clearly the policy could be reinstated as one thing, but beyond that, like, how does the organization really reconcile, you know, this difference? Do you see opportunity to promote healing and understanding?
Because I was exited from the 4-H organization for making this proposal, I really don't, you know, I don't have a voice in what will happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
All I can do is tell the story as I perceived it, as I felt it in my own skin, right? What I do lament is that 4-H lost an opportunity to really tell youth that they belong in their program. And I wish they would have done it. I never understood why hate had to carry this day. And I probably never will. And I'm very sorry, because to me, 4-H is about love. It's about belonging. It's about working together. It's about positive role models. You know, when we have youth, you know, across the United States who sometimes they feel so depressed, you know, LGBTQ youth, they feel so depressed and so alone that they kill themselves. I do think 4-H had a wonderful opportunity to make things be better for them. And I think they lost that opportunity. They lost that moral ground, and whatever they do from here on out is going to be recovery.
Yeah, it certainly sent a message that is going to be hard to take back and recover from in the future for that community. Absolutely. And I just wonder, like, what do you think it says? I mean, do you think this is a statement about the institution of 4-H, that it can't change? Or is this really a political message from the Trump administration? I mean, under the Obama administration, the organization was clearly moving in this direction in a significant way.
So, you know, again, I don't speak for the Trump administration, but yes, they made a statement about who belongs and not by removing those policies. Here in Iowa, where we have strong civil rights protections for LGBTQ youth, I don't understand why the Iowa program decided not to support its youth.
This 4-H controversy to me is it is the specific controversy, but it's also sort of a national dialogue. I guess I just wonder, like, what you've learned, or what path you might see, you know, going forward to solving some of the issues that were so present in the 4-H controversy in Iowa.
I think something that's important to say is that this did not come from 4-H. Remember, the 4-H leaders at the national level had voted that inclusion was the most important aspect of their work until 2025. This came from outside. It came from the administration, and it came from the extension system in Iowa. It did not come from the 4-H program. So that's something that I hope people understand. Part of the commitment that I had to 4-H is because I wanted every youth to be part of 4-H. That was my goal. And so, but you are correct. We are in a time where making statements like we want every youth, that we want immigrant youth, we want youth who are youth of color in our program, we want youth who are LGBTQ in our program, we want youth who were migrant workers or the children of migrant workers in our program, we want kids with disabilities, for some reason has become so politicized as to fall into the divisions that we already have in our country. In spite of those kids' rights, civil rights to be able to be in that program.
Well, John Paul, thank you so much for your time today. And thank you for providing such an inspiring model of youth development and inclusion with your work at the Iowa 4-H. I hope that that work is able to continue in one form or another within that program. And I know you're certain to carry it on in your next role.
Thanks to Jason, John Paul, and Sunny Ramaswamy for participating in today's show. In today's show notes, we're going to link to Jason's reporting, the original LGBTQ guidance from Iowa and the USDA, as well as media covering some of the programming that John Paul offered in Iowa. If you have any feedback for us or thoughts on this story, please share them on our Instagram, @YoungFarmersPodcast. Also, have you rated and reviewed this show yet? We would love to hear what you have to say. Just put it on iTunes. It takes a minute, and it really does help people find us. This show was recorded at Radio Kingston, and it was edited by Hannah Beal. We will see you next week.